Don't you wish you could just stop, right? There's probably a lot of things in life we wish we could just stop. Maybe you bite your nails. Quit. Just stop, right? Or maybe you, is anybody an overthinker? Like something happens, it swirls and blossoms and balloons out of control, and everybody's like, how did you get from here? Stop it, right? Or maybe you have a bad case of foot and mouth syndrome. And you just have this knack for saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. Quit! Stop, right? We wish we could stop these things. But it's not that simple, is it? There's probably some sinful things in our lives we wish we could stop, too. Like maybe gossip. Maybe you know it's wrong to talk about other people, and you really even don't want to, but you just find yourself, you open your mouth, and just, did you hear about so-and-so and such doing the thing at the place with the, you know... And you, it's not great, but you wish you could just stop, but you can't. Or maybe it's anger, you know? Maybe you just kind of fly off the handle, or you have a fuse about this big, and you know you get way angrier than you should at a situation, and you wish you could change, but it's just hard. You can't stop it, right? There's a lot of stuff in life we probably wish we could just stop. But there's temptation around every corner. And it seems like every day we wake up, there's a new challenge, there's a new opportunity to stumble, to trip, to fall. If we could just turn it off, if we could just stop sinning, just stop it, the world would look very different because we would all just be good, righteous, upstanding people all the time. But we're not, are we? If we're honest, we're not. Temptation is everywhere. So how do we overcome if we can't simply stop it, right? That's our conversation this morning. This is going to be a continuation of a series that we started last month called A Year-ish with Jesus. Turns out the life of Jesus is really interesting, and you can't fit it into a year. At least I don't know how to. And so we're going to take about a year and a half to just work through the book of Matthew. And we're going to walk with Christ through his life, sit at his feet, hear what he has to teach, look at what he does, and just grow closer to him through that experience. And today we're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 4. So if you have a Bible with you, I want to encourage you to open that up to Matthew 4. We'll bring the lights up just a little bit so everybody can see that. If you don't have your Bible with you, it's no sweat. We always put the passage on the screen behind, or probably your better option, you can download the FCC Monmouth app to your mobile device, and you can tap the Sunday button in the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. You'll find a tool called Sermon Notes that's got our passage pulled up, broken down, our sermon outline, a bunch of notes, some resources for you. It's really a great way to take advantage of our time together and get the most out of it. So, Matthew chapter 4. Before we dive into our passage, let's set the scene a little bit so we can appreciate the context. At the second half of Matthew chapter 3, Jesus experienced a really significant moment in his life and ministry. He's baptized. He goes down to the Jordan River, John the Baptist baptizes him, and it's not for the forgiveness of sins, but rather his baptism functions as sort of this official kickoff for his ministry. If you've been with us through Matthew, you've read the birth story and the narrative that we cover through Advent, and then we learn about John the Baptist, and now things are really going to get rolling because Jesus has been baptized. And there's a lot of things woven into this scene that alert us to this official kickoff. Like the Holy Spirit shows up, kind of doing the Napoleon Dynamite here, but the Holy Spirit shows up kind of like a dove. And it's very reminiscent of Genesis chapter 1 when the Spirit of God hovers, and the Hebrew word is actually more flutters, above the waters of creation. It's almost as if God is saying there's a new beginning taking place here at the outset of Jesus' ministry. And then we hear this voice from the heavens say, "This is my Son whom I love, with him I am well pleased." And aside from just being a very encouraging statement from God the Father, this is actually a couple of Bible verses woven together. Psalm chapter 2, I believe it's verse 7. Isaiah chapter 42, both of those passages speaking about the King of Israel, God sending a chosen servant who would work his will and bring salvation to his people, kind of all weaves together to set the scene and just elevate this message that Jesus is the guy. He's the one that God sent. He's the one that's going to inaugurate his kingdom on earth. He's the one that's going to bring this ministry of salvation to its fruition. And you would think, after a really big spiritual moment like this, like one of those big spiritual milestones, that Jesus' campaign would just hit the ground running and we'd have healings and exorcisms and all this stuff. But that's not what happens. Immediately, we go to Matthew chapter 4, verse 1, and instead, this is what we find. Then this Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Just this has nothing to do with our message this morning. It's just too good of a devotional moment to kind of miss. If you have ever had one of those really big spiritual moments, maybe it was your baptism, or it was a decision in your life to get more serious about your faith, or you're going to repent of a sin, and you really just pursued God in one of those big milestones, only to then find things got a lot harder, or temptation got ratcheted up, or life just kind of fell apart. That's not an unusual circumstance. In fact, you stand in good company, because that's exactly what happened to Jesus. Big spiritual milestone, only to be found in the next verse being tempted by the devil himself. It's almost as if this is kind of to be expected. So I don't want you to be discouraged or to think maybe I did the wrong thing. Maybe don't think any of that. You're doing exactly what you're supposed to do and trying to walk forward in faith. There's just somebody that really doesn't like that. Anyway, that's got nothing to do with our message, just a devotional moment. So anyway, we find ourselves looking at Jesus being tempted in the wilderness. But this temptation is also kind of a test. And those two concepts are two sides of the same coin. In fact, the Greek word that Matthew uses here, if you didn't know, New Testament was originally written in Greek, but that word can either mean test or temptation, depending on the context. And both concepts are pretty appropriate here. Because as we read, it's the Spirit of God that led him into the wilderness. This is God's will that he go into this place and experience this situation and circumstance. In that regard, it's a test. And tests are not bad things, by the way. If somebody loves you and gives you a test, it's an opportunity for you to excel. It's an opportunity for you to choose what is right and what is good. It's an opportunity to prove something, not just to them, but to yourself as well. Tests can be incredibly beneficial things. But true to form, Satan slithers into this story, and he takes this wonderful test and twists it a little bit and turns it into a temptation, an opportunity to fail, to become faithless, and to derail the entire mission of God. So it's appropriate to see both of those at play here, and that's really the point where our passage becomes relevant to our conversation. We're talking about how do we overcome temptations in our lives. We can't just flip a switch and stop. So how do we progress? How do we move forward? And Jesus really models something significant for us in this story. Overcoming begins by viewing every temptation as a test. We oftentimes view temptation in a solely negative light, as if it is this great burden, as if it is a tool of the enemy, if its entire purpose for existing is just to derail us and snare us and cause us to fall. Now, I'm not advocating we go out and search for temptation. That's a fool's errand. Don't do that. But it is inevitably going to find its way into our lives. And when it does, we need to recognize, yes, it could be this great stumbling block, or it could be this great opportunity to choose God over myself, to choose faithfulness over sin and the allures of this world, and to prove the genuineness of my faith. After all, a faith that is untested is really a faith that is unproven. And that's true of a lot of things in life. It's easy to be faithful or loyal to something when the road is paved and smooth and free of difficulties. It's a whole other story to be faithful or loyal to something when the road is fraught with difficulties. You take sports, for instance, rather an innocuous example. You ever notice when a team is doing really well, maybe they go into the championship, just how many people wear the colors? Like if a team's going to the Super Bowl, it seems like everybody's got a jersey or they got a cap or they changed their social media profile. And it's like, I didn't even know you knew what a football was, let alone you were a Steelers fan, right? Like everybody is on, they're all a fan when it's easy, when the team's doing good. But when a team's not doing so hot, when it's a rebuilding year, how many people wear that jersey or that cap? It's only the truly loyal and faithful fans that will stand behind their team when times are hard and difficult. I gotta say, I give Cubs fans a really hard time. But I will give them this. They have some of the most loyal fans in baseball. They've had to. Because prior to 2016, they went 100, I don't know why you're laughing, this is a very sincere compliment. They went 108 years without a championship. That's a long and illustrious legacy of losing. And in that time period, the world saw a number of monumental accomplishments. We saw the invention of the television. We saw the invention of penicillin. We put a man on the moon. We accomplished so many great and wondrous things, but the one thing that just seemed out of reach was a Cubs championship. And yet they wore the colors, and they wore the jerseys, and they went to the games. Lesser fans like myself would have been ashamed and embarrassed, but not them. They were genuine. They proved themselves true. And yes, it's a backhanded compliment, but that's the most you can expect out of me, okay? I live near St. Louis. So you get my point, though. That's a loyal fan base. Times were hard, and yet they stood true. They proved themselves genuine. That same potential is presented to us in times of temptation. They can be tests. Will I choose the ways of God's kingdom, or will I choose the ways that this world promotes? Will I choose to trust that God genuinely has my best interests at heart, or will I indulge the desires of my flesh? Will I prove that I really believe he's worth following? That's the opportunity presented to us in times of temptation. It's a test and a golden chance to prove the genuineness of our faith, not just to God, but to ourselves as well. But that requires a great shift in our thinking to view temptation through that lens. And formulating that lens really requires us to live by certain values and certain truths, things that we build our lives and our whole identities and our understanding on. And Jesus models some of those essential spiritual truths for us in his own temptations. We see those as we take a closer look. He reminds us first, and this one may be the most important. They're all important, but this one, maybe not important, most applicable. Remember that life is more than merely matters of the flesh. Remember that life is more than matters of the flesh. Here's how Jesus experiences this temptation and embodies this value. Let's look at verse 2. It says, after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. And the tempter came to him and said, if you're the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread. And Jesus answered, it is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. Now, there are a lot of little details in these opening verses that kind of clue us in into the bigger picture happening here. First off, Jesus is in the wilderness. And the wilderness is traditionally a place where God's people experience testing. And God even says as much. Deuteronomy chapter 4, he says to his people, I think it's chapter 4, don't quote me on that. But he says in the book of Deuteronomy, I sent you to wander in the wilderness for 40 years that I might humble and test you. This is a time of testing for God's people. And this is the most notable example of wandering in the wilderness. The Israelites had come out of Egypt. They had proven themselves unfaithful. And so they needed a time period of cultivation, a time to prove the genuineness of their commitment to this covenant. And so they wandered through the wilderness. And for 40 years, they had to rely on God and his promises, primarily his promise of provision. Because you got like a million plus people wandering in the wilderness. It's not like you can stop at Subway and get some cold cuts every day. They had to have food, they had to have water, and so every day for 40 years, they just had to trust that God would provide the manna, that he would provide the quail, that he would provide the water that he said he would. And their whole existence was dependent upon him keeping his word. And there were temptations in that time, temptations to doubt, temptations not to trust, temptations to trust what their eyes could see and their flesh was experiencing over the promises of the God who had delivered them. And Jesus finds himself in kind of a similar situation in the wilderness, sitting there, maybe not wandering, but in the wilderness for 40 days, experiencing very similar temptations. Will he depend upon God to sustain him? Will he trust in God's promises and goodness and his intentions? Or will he trust merely in what his eyes can see and what his stomach is grumbling for? And that's where Satan enters in. He says, you know, Jesus, you're hungry. It's been 40 days. Make a snack. You get some rocks, just turn them into bread and eat. And it's a temptation that plays off of the hungers, the desires, his needs of his flesh. And it's a temptation that you and I can probably relate with pretty easily. It may be the most common source of temptation in our lives. Our bodies are put together in such a way that we have certain drives. And God put us together in this way for good reason. For instance, we have a sex drive. That's essential to the continuation of the human species. And we are driven to satisfy that drive. And that's fine. And that's good. But sometimes temptation slithers in and we are tempted to satisfy that drive beyond the good intentions of God outside of the marriage covenant. a covenant designed to protect and to promote that drive in healthy ways. Or we have this drive for security, right? Homeostasis, to have that stability in our lives. That's a good drive. It causes us to make good decisions. It leads us to be responsible people that accumulate and promote development of the family and the community in healthy ways. That's really good. But sometimes we're tempted to satisfy that drive in ways outside of God's good intentions. And so maybe it drives us to be a little greedy or to be deceitful or to take advantage of those weaker than ourselves so that we can secure resources and feel more secure. This is where temptation comes in. It plays off of our drives, and it tempts us to satisfy them in ways beyond God's good intentions. That's what happens here with Christ. There's nothing wrong with making a snack. There's nothing wrong with feeding yourself some bread when you're hungry. The temptation for Jesus is not to eat bread. The temptation is to resist relying on God's faithfulness and provision and instead take matters into his own hands and provide for himself because he does not trust the Lord. It's a temptation to satisfy the needs and the desires of the flesh over the needs and the desires of the spirit. It's a very common temptation that we experience in our lives. Temptation to satisfy the grumblings of our belly. And again, there's nothing wrong with experiencing those desires. But how will we satisfy them? Will we trust? That's the question. That's what Israel wrestled with in the wilderness, by the way. For 40 years, their stomachs grumbled. For 40 years, they ate this stuff called manna and this quail. And at first, that's great, but you know, I get tired of leftovers after like 2 or 3 days, let alone 40 years. And so they began to complain, and they began to grumble and question God's good intentions. That temptation led them into sin. And sometimes our desires and the temptations that accompany it, it leads us into sin as well. We experience this a lot through a fear of scarcity. This is maybe a common thing. We experience this fear of scarcity. What if I don't have enough? What if I don't have enough food? Maybe we experience that, maybe we don't. Maybe more commonly, what if I don't have enough money? What if I don't have enough time? What if I don't have enough stuff? Not even in a materialistic way, but we need genuinely need things to live and to thrive. Like you need a car that can get you to work. What if I don't have enough stuff? We experience this fear of scarcity. These drives and these needs in our lives that God promises to satisfy and fulfill and to sustain us in, and yet we question. And that questioning and that fear can lead us into sinful behaviors. It can lead us to be withholding. It can lead us maybe to be a little self-centered, to resist being generous, to resist being serving of others and lending a helping hand. It can lead us into pretty silly things too. Tell me if you've ever done this. You've been going through your garage, your basement, your junk closet, or maybe your clothes closet, and you find something that you haven't touched in years. You forgot you even owned it. Or you find some outfit or some shirt in your closet, and it's just god-awful. It's never coming back in style, right? It's the tackiest thing you own. But you say to yourself, what if I need it, right? What if, I know I haven't touched it in years, but 6 months from now, if a situation arises and I need it, what if I don't have it? I better hold on to it some more. Has anybody ever done that? We've all done that, right? It makes no sense, but it stems from this fear of scarcity. What if I don't have enough? Rarely do we stop to question the assumptions baked into that question, though. What if I don't have enough? Kind of assumes God doesn't care if you have what you need. Yes, he said he will provide and care for me, but what if I don't have enough? I better take matters into my own hands and satisfy these drives myself. That question kind of assumes that maybe God's incapable. Even though he says, seek first his kingdom and all these things will be given unto you as well. Even though he gives assurances that he feeds the birds of the air and clothes the fields of the grass, how much more valuable are you than these? Maybe he's not capable of satisfying my needs and the things that sustain me. I better take matters into my own hands. That's the temptation that we face when we prioritize the flesh. It's the temptation Israel experienced in the wilderness and why Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 8 said to them, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. It's the same words that Jesus finds himself speaking when he's tempted in a very similar situation in the same kind of place. And it's the lesson that you and I would do well to learn this morning and to embody Life is more than just matters of the flesh. It is more than just what I desire, what I crave, what I need in my physical form and existence. I have needs of the Spirit. I have needs for obedience. I have needs for righteousness. I have needs for virtue. Those are every bit as significant as those needs of my flesh. And when I starve these, my life suffers as a result. That's why it's not uncommon to hear stories of people who seemingly have it all together, who have success, who have wealth, who have security, and yet find themselves miserable and empty because they have satisfied the flesh at the expense of the Spirit. There is a whole sphere of existence that we need to remember is equally as important as what we see, is what we feel, is what we desire, and what we hunger. Life is more than just matters of the flesh. And when we can embody that virtue and that value in our lives, we can begin to look at these temptations as opportunities. I have the opportunity to really trust that God can provide, to really trust that God will sustain just like he said he would. I have the opportunity to choose his ways over the cravings of my flesh. I have the opportunity to say, I really believe you're worth following. That's a gift, if we can learn to see it. There's a second value that Jesus embodies for us in his second temptation. Remember that God is not subject to our expectations. This is another big one. Let's take a look at how Jesus experiences this. This is verse 5. It says, the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. If you're the Son of God, he said, well, throw yourself down. For it's written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. Then Jesus answered him, it's also written, do not put the Lord your God to the test. So for this temptation, Satan whisks Jesus up to the temple mount, probably the highest point on the temple. And he says, look, here's the deal. You're obviously a big fan of the Bible. Doesn't it say in the Bible that God won't allow his chosen one to even stub his toe? Well, here's your chance to prove not only are you his chosen one, but that God will keep his word. All you got to do is just jump off this building, Jesus, and he'll send angels to catch you. And that may sound silly, but here's the real temptation involved in that. Satan is suggesting this scenario in which God has to prove himself in a specific way that is beneficial to Jesus that he has manufactured. It's a manipulation of God and his goodness. God, you said you'd catch me. Whee! Right? That's the scenario here. And that may sound silly, but it's actually a scenario that we can relate with because sometimes we're guilty of it. God, you said you loved me, right? So why didn't I get that new job? Or God, you said you cared about me, so why did I receive that diagnosis? God, you said you would bless me, so why are the circumstances of my life unfolding in the way that they are? It's not very satisfying. We oftentimes have this expectation that God is going to work on our lives and bless us and move in a particular way, and that particular way just happens to line up with what our will and hearts most desire, as if it's his responsibility to meet our expectations, when really, we are not equals in this scenario. I shared a couple weeks ago, my 6-year-old son, his penmanship's not great. He comes by that naturally. My penmanship, not great either. But I've worked hard as a kid to kind of make that legible so we can do better. So I empathize with him, and I want to try to help him out. So we were doing math homework the other day, and he had to write down a 9. And he tries to make his 9s look like, you know, on a keyboard. It's like got that curvy part on the bottom. It kind of loops up. So he does it like that, but it ends up laying on its side and looking like a lazy lowercase g. And you don't know what it is. That's why I said, hey, buddy, why don't we erase that? Let's make our 9 the right way. And he said, I'll tell you what, Dad. Let me tell you, I love when he starts the conversation with that. I'll tell you what, Dad. I'll make my 9s different if you make your 2s different. All right, now, this isn't like an insecure thing, okay? My toes are perfectly legible. They're not going to win any beauty contests, all right? These are not the world's greatest 2s. But you can tell that it's a 2. Here's the thing. He just wants to negotiate because he wants to try to control the situation a little bit because bad penmanship is not the only thing he inherited from me. But anyway, so, you know, it's true. I'm a control freak. So anyway, he's trying to negotiate with me as if we are equals in this scenario, forgetting that one of us is just beginning his academic career, and one of us has gone through way too much school to talk about. One of us is like just the student. One of us is in the role of the teacher. One of us bought and paid for the table, the pencil, and the paper you're using, and one of us is just a little mooch. Like, we're not equals in this scenario at all. And yet he is kind of expecting that I will acquiesce to the expectations of a six-year-old. It ain't gonna happen, folks. You can change your nines, buddy. But sometimes we do that same sort of thing with God, forgetting that one of us is the maker and the sustainer of all existence, and one of us is merely a part of that existence because he is good and loving. One of us scooped up dirt from the earth and breathed into it the breath of life, and one of us, once the breath of life leaves, will return to dust. One of us is the judge of eternal destinies, and one of us will stand before and answer him. We are not equals in this scenario. One of us is God, and one of us is not. And when we are tempted to live otherwise, we relive the experiences of the Israelite to whom Moses said, "Do not test the Lord your God." We relive the experience of Jesus, who quotes those same words to Satan as he is tempted to manipulate and twist God's arm into meeting his expectations. We relive this scenario in which we have the opportunity to remember who is God and who is not. We have this opportunity in temptation to humble ourselves before him and to acknowledge your ways really are higher than mine. And this opportunity to acknowledge, I may not understand why everything happens the way that it does, but I do trust that your intentions for me are good. And we have this opportunity to affirm you're worth trusting and following. And while it may not always be what I hoped for and desired and willed, I do trust that it is best because you have let it happen. Temptation can be a test and a golden opportunity to prove the genuineness of this faith if we can learn to see it as such. But again, that requires incorporating some significant truths and values into our lives. And there's one final one that Jesus demonstrates for us in his last temptation, one that's probably very relevant for us almost every day. Shortcuts will always shortchange when it comes to blessing. Shortcuts will always shortchange us when it comes to blessing. Here's how Jesus experiences and embodies this in verse 8. "Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. 'All this I will give you,' he said, 'if you will bow down and worship me.' And Jesus said to him, 'Away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only.' And then the devil left him, and angels came and attended him." So for this final round of temptation, Satan whisks Jesus off, shows him the kingdoms of the world, and says, "This can be yours. You can have the glory. You can have the splendor. You can be king. And here's the best part of all. You don't have to deal with any of that nasty crucifixion business. You don't have to deal with the pain of rejection. You don't have to deal with the agony of death. You don't have to bear the weight of humanity's sins. All the same glory can be yours, free and easy. You just got to sacrifice your faithfulness. That's all." It's a shortcut. A shortcut that promises something that is desirable and yet will ultimately shortchange. And by the way, it's perfectly fine to desire glory and honor. In fact, we're encouraged to that. Romans chapter 7. "To those who by persistence in doing good seek out glory, honor, and immortality, he will give the gift of eternal life." That's one of the desires of our heart. God has baked in there. He's also baked into our hearts this desire for joy, for contentment, for peace, for satisfaction, for love, for blessing. All of those desires are good and worthy and ought to be cherished. But here's where temptation works its way in. All of these desires that God intends to fill our lives with most often come through times of pruning and development and growth. And worst of all, time. Who's got time for time? I want joy now. I want satisfaction now. I want blessing now. And here is sin promising a shortcut. You want joy? You want satisfaction? You could follow these kind of pruning, difficult, uncomfortable ways of God that will in time develop and grow those in you, or you could chase sexual satisfaction, you could chase substance abuse, you could chase materialism, and that dopamine hit will provide the very same kind of joy that you're seeking after, just quick and easy. You want contentment, satisfaction, peace? You could let God work in your life and plant that seed and let it root and germinate and blossom in time and through pruning, or you could take advantage of a situation, maybe be a little less than honest. You could be self-serving and selfish in your time and your energies, and it will amount for you a kingdom of satisfaction and contentment, quick and easy. Sin promises that these shortcuts are worthwhile. You'll get the desires of your heart fulfilled, but it always leaves that shortchange part out. It kind of reminds me of there was an experiment done in the 1970s. A group of preschoolers was brought together, and one by one, they were put in a room. And in this room was a researcher and a marshmallow. And the researcher said, "Hey, preschooler, I will let you have this marshmallow. I'm going to leave the room for 15 minutes, and you can eat that marshmallow if you want. But if you can wait, and I come back in 15 minutes, it's still there, I'll give you 2 marshmallows." And so they would leave, and the footage is very entertaining to watch these children try to wrestle with the temptation. Some of them, like, won't even look at the marshmallow. Some of them, that guy's out the door, and that thing's already in their mouth, right? But there were a handful of preschoolers that waited the full 15 minutes, delayed gratification, and got the reward of 2 marshmallows. The really interesting part about this experiment isn't the actual circumstances. What came after? Because they followed these kids for 40 years. And they took notes and measured the success of their lives by various different criterias. And what they found, what wasn't surprising, but it was very fascinating nonetheless, those preschoolers that could demonstrate a delayed gratification, that waited the full 15 minutes, throughout the 40 years of their lives that were measured, consistently excelled above their counterparts. They consistently demonstrated higher SAT scores. They consistently demonstrated lower dependencies on substances, lower levels of obesity and related illness, higher functioning social skills. They tended to receive higher rankings and status in their workplaces. Again and again and again, there were benefits that came into their lives because they were willing to wait. They avoided the shortcut and waited on the bigger reward that lay ahead. And there's a lot of lessons in that one little experiment that parallel what Jesus shows us here. Yes, he could have taken the shortcut. He could have received earthly glory and splendor. But someday he was still going to die. And all that short-term glory would be gone, along with it, all the eternal glory that could have been his. And so he refused to take the shortcut. And he embraced the arduous road and path that God had called him down. And yes, it involved difficulty. Yes, it involved rejection. Yes, it involved the cross. It required him to bear our sins and our guilt and to take our shame upon himself so that we could experience his innocence and righteousness. It was hard. But as a result of that, Christ was raised in a glory that Satan could never hope to match or offer. And as we read in the book of Philippians, he was given the name, the honor, the glory, the title that is above every name. That at that name and in recognition of its significance, every knee in heaven and on earth and under the earth bows, and every tongue confesses the truth of who he rightfully and truly is. Because he delayed gratification and didn't take the shortcut, he receives a throne that will never end. The glory and the splendor cannot be matched. His kingdom cannot be trampled, and it expands on and on and on, and will do so for all eternity. There was a greater blessing that came into his life because he refused to take the shortcut of sin, and that same lesson stands there for us to grab a hold of and practice in our own lives. Every day, we are presented with the opportunity to take the shortcut and to satisfy the longings of our heart with cheap imitations. And yet if we have the faithfulness to say, God, I do trust that you are working for my good. I do trust you intend for me to have joy. I do trust you intend for me to have contentment. I do trust you intend for peace and blessing to fill my life. And I'm willing to follow you, even if it's difficult and long. I am going to follow you faithfully because you are worth following. That's the test. The golden opportunity that's put before us when temptation comes knocking on our door. If we can learn to see it and embody these insignificant, important values that Jesus demonstrates for us in the times of his temptations. Temptation's a weird thing because it is kind of this double-edged sword. And yes, we might stumble, we might fall, or if we can see it for what it is, we might excel and prove the genuineness of our faith, and we might grow more faithful. Our worship might become more fruitful and genuine. It could be a huge boon in our walk with Christ. And even if we should fail or stumble or fall, which inevitably we will, we have the assurance that we are walking with someone who has passed the test. Not just in these three instances, but out throughout his entire humanity, succeeded where we have faltered, who was without sin, even though he was just like us. And we have the confidence of this good news and this gospel that this Jesus who succeeds is in our corner, that he extends to us this grace and this mercy and encourages us, not just that you're forgiven, but encourages us to get up and to keep going, to try it again. He encourages us this morning. Remember that life is so much more than just matters of the flesh. And he encourages us with this message. Remember that God is not subject to our expectations. Live humbly before him and taste the blessings of that. And he reminds us and encourages us this morning, shortcuts are never going to satisfy the longings of your soul. They're always going to shortchange. But rather, success, overcoming, is found when we can embrace those temptations as tests, choose to prove the genuineness of our faith, and choose to follow God over ourselves. Man, what a golden opportunity is put before us to prove something, not just to him, but to ourselves, to see the fruit of the Spirit at work in our lives, to be encouraged by that. And that's what I want to leave you with this morning. Inevitably, you're going to walk out these doors. You're going to go to work. You're going to go to school. You're going to go home, whatever, on Monday morning. And there's going to be temptation knocking at your door. See it for what it is, church. Resist the call of the flesh. Resist the call of our desires. And recognize this is a chance and an opportunity to take a big step forward, to offer up my best worship, and to prove the genuineness of my commitment to the Lord, because I really believe he is worth following.